It's not just a game, it's not just a grass. Lawn Solutions Australia is the exclusive home of Australia's best sports turf varieties. For the world's best grasses like Tiff Tough Hybrid Bermuda and Sir Grange Zoysia, contact Lawn Solutions Australia at lawnsolutionsaustralia.com.au. Hello and welcome to episode 103 of The Thing About Golf and another special episode in our Ryder Cup run-up. In European Ryder Cup history, there are a couple of names and moments synonymous with the event. The biggest is, of course, Seve, but not far behind will be the name of Scotland's Sam Torrance. Torrance is now best known as a TV commentator, but he has a long history both with the game and the Cup. John Huggan joins me now. And Huggy, must be nice these past couple of weeks for you to chat with a few Scots. Sam might be at least as well known for the profile of his father as his playing career, but certainly in Scotland, golfing royalty, Sam Torrance.
Absolutely. Sam's a bit of a legend, certainly in Scotland. As you pointed out, he's had a couple of really iconic moments in the Ryder Cup, none bigger, than the winning putt in 1985 at the Belfry, which was Europe's first ever victory. Everybody's seen the picture of him with his arms spread after he held the putt. I think we make the point in the podcast somewhere, I think I did, Andy North, his opponent that day. It was a really nice thing Andy North did, because Sam, to be honest, had about four putts to win the hole in the match from there. And it would have been easy for Andy North to walk forward and just shake his hand, but he let Sam have his moment, which I thought was a really nice touch and one that shouldn't be ignored.
No, indeed. He's a big character, Sam Torrance, isn't he? I think that's part of the appeal. He's a very popular figure in golf. He's a big character, perhaps a bigger character even than his golf game in some ways.
Yes, I would say that he's one of the few that, certainly in Scotland. I mean, most people in Scotland have got, some kind of awareness of golf, but even those that don't have much in that department would know the name Sam Torrance, and maybe even his father Bob, who was one of the best teachers ever. You'd have to say. I mean, a borderline genius. I mean, I don't think there's anybody who ever went to get lessons from Bob didn't hit the ball better after those lessons. And Sam, Sam was born to play golf in that respect, certainly.
Yeah, but Harrington talked extensively about that with you, Bob Torrance, didn't he? If you know anything about golf, you certainly know the name Bob Torrance and his sort of specialness in the world of golf. What was your take from Sam about the Ryder Cup and its importance? We've sort of discussed a couple of times over the unfolding of this series, the changing nature of the Ryder Cup amongst fans and players as well. What was your take from Sam about the role it played for him in his career?
Well, it was huge, because Sam was one of a group of players. I've written about this a couple of times. Sam, Howard Clark, Mark James, Ken Brown, that kind of group, who were all perennial Ryder Cup players, but kind of one step down from the Seve, Faldo, Woosnam, Lyle, Langer group, the kind of superstar group. But they were very important to the Ryder Cup, and the Ryder Cup was very important to them, because that era, if those guys were around now, they'd be playing in four majors every year. They'd all comfortably be in the top 50 in the world. Back then, though, they didn't get to play in the majors. Yeah. So the Ryder Cup became their major, if you like.
Yeah.
And that's where, certainly Sam Torrance made his reputation.
We forget how recent the structure of the game is that we see today, isn't it? That's less than a generation ago. Players who were successful and renowned Ryder Cup players didn't get starts in majors just from being a member of the Ryder Cup. It's extraordinary to think about.
Well, the line I always use, and I've overdone it maybe, but when Seve won the Masters for the first time in 1980, he was playing in the tournament because he'd finished in the top one at the Open the previous year. If he'd been runner-up in the Open at Lytham, he wouldn't necessarily have been in the Masters. Unbelievable, isn't it?
We argue about the world rankings and their merit. I know you're one who's in favour of perhaps just scrapping it, but in some senses, that's one thing that it has done, isn't it? It's ensured that most people who belong in majors do get in, which certainly wasn't the case sort of previously. I think I'm going to enjoy listening to Sam's voice as much as his stories in this one, Huggy. He's had the good fortune to be born with an extraordinary voice, which I think is probably part of the success of his TV commentary too. It's a delight to listen to, isn't it?
Yeah, he's just as well he's not his dad, actually, because his dad had an almost impenetrable Scottish accent. That if you weren't Scottish, you were having a hard time understanding Bob. But Sam does sound great on television.
He does indeed. Well, it's going to be a treat for us to listen to him. I'm sure that you enjoyed having a chat to him. Thanks for joining us to meet Sam Torrance.
My pleasure.
Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast. My guest this time around is, I have to say, something of a legend where I come from. Sam Torrance, what was and is the thing about golf for you?
A way of life, John, to be honest. I started when I was five. My father taught me all my life, turned pro at 17, and spent the next 44 years travelling the world playing golf. Down to Australia quite a few times too. Loved it down there.
Yeah, we'll Melbourne get to that Cup. In a bit. Yes. Anybody was born to play golf, it must be you, though, given who your father was.
Yeah, well, it was definitely in the blood. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was a great teacher, my father. He was a bit of a player as well, but he never took that any further. He was a greenkeeper and bricklayer to begin with. Mm-hmm. But he was a fascinating coach. He had a great eye for teaching. You know, he would never teach a method. You know, you can't teach Nick Fowler the same as Ian Woosnam.
Yeah.
You know, he would look at you and see what you can do to improve it.
Yeah, everybody I've ever talked to, and I knew your dad, you know, reasonably well, he made everybody hit the ball better. Did he ever have a failure?
I mean, he never looked at you, did he?
No, well, that's true.
Could have been the first man. No, yeah, he was a great listener, my father. He knew what was going on in people's heads, and a bit of a psychologist in a way as well as a teacher.
Yeah.
He knew the swing inside out. He read every book known to man. Hogan, he always said Hogan was his hero.
Yeah.
And he went and visited Hogan twice, which was very special. But deep down, Sam Snead.
Really?
That was the swing.
That's interesting.
That was the swing that he liked the best. But he never let that one out the bag.
No, he never told me that, that's for sure.
No.
Yeah, certainly wouldn't tell any journalist.
No.
Did he teach you any differently than he taught everybody else, given the father-son?
As I said, I mean, what a bonus to have someone that loves you teaching you. He never heard anything from anyone.
No.
It's difficult to say. He certainly gave me everything.
Would you have spoken to him differently had he just been your coach, do you think?
Actually, I'd probably have been a bit more respectful, which is a sad thing to say, but you know, boys and their dads,
we
used to have such arguments. The best one, or the worst one, was, you know, he always told me, if you don't take it with you, you won't find it there. Mm-hmm. Meaning, and I so believe this, meaning you do all your work at home, and then you go to a tournament with a free mind.
Yeah.
So that was magnificent for me. You'd never have seen me very, very rarely on the range after I finished a round. I'd be out of there, back to the hotel, watch TV, go to the movies.
Yeah.
Something, but I would not be beating balls all afternoon, you know, because if you've got a fault in your swing, you're only endorsing it into your swing. But then, of course, the years passed, my father started teaching a lot more golfers. And then he eventually came on tour. And, you know, finished a round, they said, right, well, you need to go to the range. And I looked at him and said, Dad, what for, next week?
Right.
You know, I'm not going to find it, Dad, I'm not going to bring it, I'm not going to find it here. So, no, all the arguments, but I was right. At least I think it was right.
Well, anyway, for you, maybe. Did your understanding of the golf swing, in general, or just your own swing?
Absolutely, not even my own.
Really?
I just did as I was told, never asked why. It came to bear me trouble with my son. I love my son so much, but I can't teach him. You know, he's a really good golfer, Daniel, but I couldn't teach him. I don't have the teaching knowledge. You know, it's just not there. You know, I can tell little things, little swing thoughts, but not basics, not right in deep and make things work for
It's an art form, isn't it, teaching?
Of course it is. Yeah. It's as much an art form as playing.
Yeah.
Maybe even more.
Yeah.
You know, I just, you know, did what I was told. And they say, why, Dad? Well, he wasn't the kind of man you'd want to question anyway.
No.
When he told you something, you listened, and I did.
Absolutely.
You know, I worked very hard with him. He was wonderful that way. But no, I'm sad I was never able to teach.
Yeah. And he would stay out there as long as it took.
I'd be out there from dawn to dusk. With my mother sitting on the wee side.
Yeah.
Well, I know my poor mother. She loved him dearly. And she sat there, cup of coffee. So basically, so she could keep bloody eye on him.
Aye. Yeah.
There was a bit of a drinker in this time with Dad. And, you know, one's too many and 100 is not enough.
Aye.
Quite a true story.
Yeah, well, I know. I know, but he did well with that in the end, didn't he? I
mean, oh, yeah, yes, yes. Yeah, he was an alcoholic, but he cured it, sorted it.
Yeah. I had a lot of admiration for your dad, as much for that as I did for the fact that it's what a great teacher he was. Yeah. I don't think America ever knew what a great teacher he was, because half the time they couldn't understand what he was saying.
Yeah, very strong accent. Yeah,
you had to be Scottish to understand some of it, I think.
Yeah. And a few of them, Tom Watson, and I'm trying to remember, he was a good impersonator of Craig Stadley. He used to put golf balls up his shirt. What's his
name?
Peter Jacobson. He had some wonderful stories about my dad. Uh-huh. And others, you know, they got to me and say, I've talked to your dad for 20 minutes and I had no idea what he said. But, you know, they would know when he's talking about the swing.
Yeah. I mean, I remember seeing your This Is Your Life program on the telly. And I think they sussed quite early on that your mum better do the talking rather than your dad. For the audience.
Interpreter required.
I know. Which was a shame, because he had great stuff to say.
You could understand.
Well,
one of his best lines, when the press at the Open, the press award, what was it called?
Yeah, the Golf Writers.
Golf Writers Award. And he stood up and, you know, I knew he was nervous. I was frightened he was going to drink, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. And he got up and he kind of, he was almost looking out the back instead of looking at the crowd. And he says, you know, I'm not very good at this, speaking. And he says, and I don't think this is the place to practice. He had a great sense of humour.
Aye. And he was, he said some nice things about your mum that night, I remember. And I remember her telling me afterwards that it was the most dramatic thing he's ever said to me.
Exactly. I don't know what he was after.
No. Anyway, let's get back to you. This is more to the point. You turned pro very early. Was that a conscious decision? Were before the American college thing would be.
Oh, I don't think I've ever played in an amateur event. I think I played, there was one in Troon, the Troon Open Amateur. I won that as a 15-year-old or something. But I never played in the British Amateur or Scottish Amateur or anything like that. But I turned pro at 16 or 17.
Right.
I left school at 13. It's what I wanted to do. It was what I was best at. And I just loved it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I got my card in my first year and never lost it for 45 years. So, I mean, it was my life. It is my life. It's a wonderful life to travel the world. And you did a lot more traveling in those days. You know, our tour, we didn't play, I think it was the week after the Masters, before the first tournament, was in Europe. And I don't know when we finished, September maybe. And then we would go to South Africa for 4 or 5 weeks, then East Africa, which I loved, Nigeria, Kenya, and Zambia. Yeah. Some stories from there, my God. But it was a fascinating place.
Yes.
And then Asia for 6 weeks. And that was just magnificent. Yeah. Going to Hong Kong, Singapore, all these wonderful places.
Young boy
places.
With wide eyes, were you?
And, well, in Nigeria, all I ate was tomato sandwiches. The place in a lovely, lovely house with a Barclays Bank manager. The Yoles used to stay with the expatriates, and he had this chef, and all I would have was tomato sandwiches. Even I couldn't get near any other food. I was just terrified.
Yeah.
And then when I went to Asia, I ended up having a dish called nasi goreng for breakfast with a wee bowl of chilies in it. I mean, it was just magnificent. And it gave me a great zest for life. The food has been a big part of my life, you know, and I absolutely adored that.
Yeah, you touched on the travel part of it. That interested me. I did a wee bit of research. Can you believe before we did this interview, Sam? That's a novelty. And I tell you what impressed me almost more than anything. Obviously, great record, but you won all over the place.
Yeah.
Now you must be proud of that.
Colombian Open.
Yeah.
Watch all these Narcos things. I love those the Narcos movies and box sets. And I was there at the time.
Right.
I mean, I really was. I was right there up in Medellin.
Yeah.
And all this stuff's going on around the country. We had no idea. No idea. But magnificent places. And Colombia, a fabulous place. I beat Trevino there. Mm-hmm. He was second, which was a real feather in my cap. Zambia, I won the Zambian Open. Tunisia. Of course, that was on the European tour by then, I think.
Was that part of it because you were so comfortable with the travel? I mean,
I loved it.
It's difficult to play when you're not quite comfortable or happy.
Very happy. I was very happy. I was great in my own company.
Aye.
You know, I didn't mind. I was a great avid reader. Reading was just huge to me. You know, as soon as I sat in an aeroplane, the book would be out. And I've seen me walking down the aisle still reading it to go off the plane.
What do you mean?
Fiction, basically.
Right,
a few autobiographies. I mean, Wilbur Smith in the old days used to love his books, and Tom Clancy, and even The Carpetbaggers, Harold Robbins, he did some great books. But once, and I loved finding a new author.
Right.
You know, it was exciting. And now with the iPad, that you just, I mean, I take 100 books with me everywhere I go because they're just in your iPad. It's a much easier way to read.
Yeah.
But that helped me a lot.
And what was the strength of your game that enabled you?
I was a great driver. I was a good driver of the ball. My long iron play was average. I hit it very low. Almost one of my earliest tournaments was at Wilmslow in the Manchester Open. And I was playing with, and I'll never forget this, playing with Nick Faldo. And on the second hole, the pin's front left, and it's like a 2-iron shot. And he hit this 2-iron way up in the sky, and it just landed like an old dog in front of the fire beside the flag. And I just looked at it, but I'm in the wrong game.
No.
I mean, I could still be standing there, couldn't hit that shot until I got a 7-wood. And then I could.
Yeah.
I would just hit it right of it and chip up. It just wasn't something I had in my game. I was very good from 150 yards in. Mm-hmm. I loved that. I was a really good short game.
Yeah.
And driving.
The best of those wins, though, I would have to think would be the Australian PGA in 1980.
Yes.
Is that the best win of your
career? Oh, yeah, by far. Individual win, yeah. I mean, I played with Greg and Seve the last two rounds. And I think they were 1 and 2 in the world at the time.
It would be, yeah.
And Seve actually changed my life. When I come off the last green and had won, and if his arm around me, he says, "Hey, San." He always called me San. S-A-N. He says, "Hey, San, you're very tough to beat, eh?" And coming from...
Yeah.
This was 1980. He was already a god.
Yeah, yeah.
That was huge to me.
Well, he would be Masters champion at the time. He won Masters that year.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, I mean, I'd won twice in 76. I won the Zambian Open in 75. I actually won twice my first year, 72, the under-25 match play and the Radici Open, which was the week after the Italian Open, but it wasn't on the tour. But I had no Ryder Cups.
No.
No nothing.
No.
And then when Seve told me that, I got so much self-belief. Won the Irish Open at Port Marnock in 81 to get me into my first Ryder Cup.
Yeah.
Then played the next day, fell in love with that. That was just the best.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, Seve changed me there. Yeah. I think he did the same to Jimenez.
Really?
Well, when Jimenez was vice captain at Valderrama, he was an okay player. Jimenez, you know, he wasn't that great.
No.
He really wasn't.
No.
Christ, can he play now? And right after that, I mean, he only won 21 events in Europe.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah,
oldest winner. Three times, I think, he broke it.
Played better when he grew his hair.
Well, yeah. No, he's a hell of a player. When he played in the Ryder Cup, he was really tough.
Yeah.
He was great to watch.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of that came from just being with Seve, just being in his company.
You've segued nicely into the Ryder Cup. I think if you say to somebody, Sam Torrance, that's the first thing that comes to mind. I mean,
the Ryder Cup. My record wasn't that great.
But
I was a great team man.
Yeah, you've been symbolic. I mean, everybody remembers that putt you hold to win the thing and, you know, all the rest of it. But take me back to the beginning. I mean, when did the Ryder Cup become a priority for you?
69.
As early as that?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. When Nicklaus gave Tony the putt on 18 and Brian Huggett hold the putt on 17, thinking he'd won the Ryder Cup and he hadn't.
Mm.
And that gesture from Nicklaus was very special. And I wanted in. And there was a thing called the Hennessy Cognac Cup, which became the Seve Trophy eventually. I think I was the only player to play in them all in the 70s, whenever it was.
And that was when Seve famously drove the green at the Belfry. That was a Hennessy Cognac Cup, I think. He was playing Faldo that day, believe it or not. He was.
Okay.
I've seen the pictures.
Okay. He wasn't first to drive it, though.
No.
No, Francisco Rebrew.
All right. Yeah.
He knocked it on, and I knocked it on.
Right.
But Seve is much famous than both of us put together.
Yeah.
But I actually played Seve there. That was prior to Australia. And and one down with two to play. And 17th par five, both just off the green. And I duffed my chip 6 feet in front of me, just duffed it right in front of me. Mm-hmm. And Seve chipped it up to a foot. So I had to hold this to stay in the match, and I chipped it in to get to the last tee.
Yeah, that would please
me. So I've marched over, and I've teed it up, and I'm looking at the ball, and out the corner of my eye, I can't see any feet. So look, there's nobody there. I'd gone to the ninth tee.
Oh, dear.
I was standing on the ninth tee, and in those days, this was 76, when it was quite barren.
Yeah.
And I loved the course from day one. Mm. I really did love the course. Great layout, great holes. And Seve was over there. He was on the bloody tee, and I think he would have let me hit. Because if you think of the tee shot down 9, the tee shot down 18, it's not dissimilar.
No, that's right.
I didn't hit it, and I won the last to get all square with him.
Right.
And I think that was part of the "you're very tough to beat."
Yeah, yeah.
The chip in at 17, winning the last. Yeah. But
is it possible to? I mean, he's a legend in the Ryder Cup. I mean, is it possible to overestimate his contribution?
No,
I mean he changed everything.
No. He was a king.
Yeah,
he was a king. Can I swear in this?
You can say it's whatever you want, Sam. We can bleep it out.
I'll tell you a great story.
Go on.
It's heavy.
Yeah.
One of the great things about being the Ryder Cup is being in the team room with these legends. And I was very lucky in the ones I played in. The big boys were there, Faldo, Langer, Lyle, Woozy, Seve, to be joined by Lathabal. And you can in the team room, you can ask them anything about the game, anything.
Yeah.
And there was... do anything for you that would help because they want to win the Ryder Cup.
Yeah.
So, 83 West Palm Beach, and that thick rough around the greens, I wasn't sure about it. We'd never really had it in Europe. And I asked Seve, can you see Sam? No problem. Let's go. Come on. So he took me out the chipping green, and I don't know how long we were there for, but it was magnificent. So the tournament finishes. We lost by a point. Swore on the Sunday night we will be back.
Yes.
And we will beat them. So about 2 weeks later, I don't know where we were playing, but I'm down on the chipping green behind the range in this thick stuff. And who walks past but the king? Oh, Seve, please, por favor. Un momento, please. Just have a little look at this beautiful smile. I'll never forget a smile come across his face. And he looked at me and said, "Sam, f*** off. I'll see you in 2 years.
Yeah, that's brilliant, You arrived at the right, 81... was the kind of, obviously no Seve that year, but that was really the great American team. But it was only 2 years after that
we lost
it suddenly dawned on you that you could win this thing.
Yes. Yeah. We were very unlucky in West Palm Beach. No need to gripe, no need for any reasons for anything. But we knew.
Right.
We knew. Everyone in that team room that night, Sunday night, we knew we can beat these guys.
Yeah.
No matter where it is. And of course, from 85 on, I mean, I think I know the Medina was outstanding, magnificent. But to me, the best victory was Muirfield Village, 87, captained by the king.
Yeah.
Can't really call him the king. That was Palmer. Arnold. That was Arnold. But God, my hero, Mr. Nicholas, and designed the course, captained the team. That was a tough one to win. And we hammered them.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, that was the first week with Seve and Holly.
Yep.
Langer and Lyle, Woosam and Faldo.
Yeah.
Those three groups, they won it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I played the first day with Howard Clark, and I didn't play till singles. And I didn't want to, because these boys just had it.
Yeah.
And they played golf that you wouldn't believe.
Well, that was kind of the way of things back then. I mean, Jacklin was the captain. He kind of had to ride those six guys that you mentioned as much as he could.
We were getting there, but we didn't quite have the strength and depth that obviously we have now.
Yeah.
But not even close to what we have now. I was always in that second.
Aye, well, you say that. I mean, and I've written this, and I think I've maybe said this to you before in the past, but I think I include you in the group. I mean, yourself and Mark James and Ken Brown, Howard Clark, that's down from those top guys.
Yeah, but
you never got to play in America. You never got to play in the majors, hardly ever.
No.
You were discriminated against at that point.
It's
changed now. I mean, if you were playing at that time,
top 10 the money, let's get us a card over there.
Exactly,
No, we can't gripe. We had a great time. Well, I have no complaints whatsoever. Yeah. I mean, I think I finished third in order of merit and didn't get in the Masters.
Aye. Yeah.
You know, well, the PGA were great. They let us play quite a few times. I don't know how many. I might have played 8 PGAs.
Mm. But you played 28 times in the Open, 4 times in the Masters, 3 times in the US Open, and 6 times in the PGA.
Only 6. Oh, well, they were miserable people.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know, an American would with my career would have played what, 28 times 4, whatever the hell that is. 40, 32, 72. They'd have played 72 majors.
Yeah.
I would have played 72 majors.
See, my contention always was that that group I just mentioned, of which you were part, one of you would have popped up and won one.
Possibly.
Because that's what happens now. You're not going to tell me that Jeff Sluman and Larry Mize and Bob Tway are any better than you were. No, having that.
No, I know, but they took the chances. We just, as you say, and there was so much emphasis on the Open because it was your one major every year. Yeah. And I don't know, I know I put too much pressure on myself. I really do, because it was just everything. It was just everything to win the Open. I never came close.
The Ryder Cup, I did one of these with Bernard Gallagher.
We keep bouncing off the Ryder Cup. We need to come back to it.
Well, the Ryder Cup is, you know, it's coming up. There's a reason why we're doing this. Bernard Gallagher, I spoke to him recently doing the same kind of podcast, and he made the point that in a Ryder Cup year qualifying, he played more golf in an attempt to qualify. It was that big a priority for him. Did that affect your scheduling in terms of when you were in the qualifying part?
In my first 10 years, you know how many tournaments I missed?
Well, that's true. I know you played 706.
I missed one event in my first 10 years on tour.
Is that right?
And I actually missed two, but one of them was the Summery Better Ball.
Right.
And the other one I missed because I broke my toe.
Right.
My suitcase was on the floor.
Right.
And I was going to the toilet during the night to leave the next morning. And I kicked it by accident and broke my toe. Right. Wasn't sleepwalking in any way, shape, or form. I don't know where those stories came from. But no, I played never and I loved it.
Right.
I just loved it.
So it didn't matter what.
No, I remember Jacqueline saying something early on in my career. He said, "I hope he doesn't burn himself out." And I had no idea what he was talking about.
Right.
Yeah. No idea.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe I did burn it, but I don't think so.
Well, you were young enough to get it.
Well, my best year was 95. Mm. You know, when I was 42 years of age, I won 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes the Dunhill Cup and the Ryder Cup.
Well,
I won 3 times in Europe and we won the Ryder Cup in America. So, no, I did have longevity. There's no question about that. I think it was just love for the game and not really knocking yourself out at every event. And there were certain events I went to, and I wasn't going to play golf.
Right.
I wasn't doing anything wrong in any way, shape, and form.
No.
But I'd just relax, and I'd have a few beers every night, mm-hmm. and just chill out. And I might play well, might not play well.
Yeah.
But when you play as much as I did, you kind of had to do that,
mm-hmm.
just to give yourself a break from the pressure of playing.
No. You mentioned 87. Am I right in thinking that you and your lovely wife got engaged?
Yeah, on Concord. Champagne and altitude, I put it down to.
Now, I mean, I don't mind me saying this, but there's always, Tony Jacklin used to tell this story about how.
Yeah, it's true. He told me on the Thursday night.
Go on then.
Sorry, Sam, I'm resting you tomorrow. And my head just went down. I thought, oh, God, he says you're playing. Because Suzanne and I were having a bit of fun.
Well, indeed, yes. As you should. Yeah. What would be?
The opening ceremony. We had to go along the cart path in front of the clubhouse, right up to the top where the opening ceremony was, and the reception we got. You know, all the Europeans, everybody that went up there, and it was just out of this world. And the two of us were like school kids. Mm-hmm. We got to where the ceremony was, and we looked at each other. And I said, "We'll do it again." And we ran around the back of the clubhouse, right round, and did the whole thing again. And it was just magnificent.
Yeah.
It was just magnificent.
Yeah.
Tiff Tough Hybrid Bermuda means less work and more play. Tough by name and by nature, this turf variety, supplied exclusively by Lawn Solutions Australia, is the perfect choice for your home lawn. With superior drought tolerance, speedy recovery and toughness, Tiff Tough really is the smart grass. For more information and to find your nearest accredited supplier, head to lawnsolutionsaustralia.com.au.
So this is a long list, but I mean, can you do your sort of top 3-4 highlights in Ryder Cup?
In Ryder Cups? Well, captaincy by a mile.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. Not holding the putt.
Jesus, no. No, the captaincy was way bigger than anything I've ever done in golf. It was such an accolade or such an honour to be given that job and to win. It's just even if we'd lost, it still would have been the best week of my life, yeah, by far.
And you got an extra year as captain.
Yeah, that was sad.
Not in a good way, yeah. I know.
No, yeah. No. But all the winning part was fantastic. That was very special. And the other, if you wanted three, it was definitely 95 at Oak Hill. That was the best golf I played in the Ryder Cup, mm-hmm, the whole way.
Right.
Played Larry Mize in the singles, beat him in the singles.
I told you were as good as Larry Mize.
Boston the Moss, sorry. Boston.
Oh,
it wasn't Larry Mize.
What's his name again?
I did play Larry Mize.
Lauren Roberts.
I think, yeah. Larry Mize was at Muirfield Village. Mm. But Boston the Moss, it was quite a funny thing happened. I think it was the 12th hole. And he dumped his second shot into the water, and I've followed him in like an idiot. And we go up, and I took mine a bit further back because I wanted to hit a full shot into the pin, maybe 20 yards behind him. And I've had my practice. I'm over the ball, and the referee comes around, sorry, it's not your shot. And I looked at him. I said, what do you mean it's not my shot? He's 20 yards nearer me. How can it not be my shot?
Yeah.
And the rule was, and I never knew this rule, the ball that's furthest away from the pin in the hazard is whose shot it was.
Oh, right. So it didn't really matter where you dropped at that point.
No, you know, it's still the rule.
Yeah.
It's still the rule.
Right, okay.
Never knew that rule.
I wouldn't have known that either.
So he gets to go first and he holds it. He bloody holds it. And I didn't, but I managed to beat him anyway, 2-1.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was my best playing Ryder Cup. And I'd had 93 was a nightmare for me. Wednesday, or
was that the poison
Wednesday,
toe?
Wednesday night, I got a wee blister on my little toe, on my left foot. And it was fine, it was just a wee blister. I didn't burst it in, I just left it. Mm-hmm. And then Thursday, it was getting really bad. And by Thursday night, what the hell is this? And I played with Mark James on the Friday, and I wasn't good at all. I couldn't get through the ball. And once you can't swing freely, especially in the Ryder Cup, you're really in trouble. So I had the toenail taken off that night.
Right.
I went to hospital and got a toenail taken off, but I couldn't play. That was the last I played. And I really didn't want that to be my last Ryder Cup, sort of go at it. But then 95 was just magnificent.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that, at age of 42, you were still getting better.
Yeah.
You know, that's a tribute to your dad as much as anything else. Your technique, which was built by your dad, obviously. Yeah. What sort of things did he say to you in a lesson? I mean, everybody's got tendencies.
Maybe too many. There'd be about 40 bleeps.
Right.
And then I'd have to say, you wee arsehole. So he liked to work from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
Feet work were very important. Shoulder turn. He told me very early in my career, just as a boy, actually, before I was on tour, we had a big shoulder turn. Hit it as far as you can and we'll straighten it up later.
Right.
I'm still waiting, and he's not here now. Yeah. I'm going to straighten out now, but that was huge for me.
Yeah.
Because a big shoulder turn was really my best asset. Because the length became effortless once it's in there.
You almost had that pause at the top for a while.
Always had a pause. Yeah, not for a while, my whole career. Yeah, I had a wee pause at the top.
Yeah.
And that was because the transition from backswing to downswing was so important to my dad. And if you rushed it, you were not going to swing consistently.
Yeah.
And he used to just have a wee pause at the top, and then it just lets everything fall into
place. It was very noticeable.
Back in, away it went.
Yeah.
I haven't got it now, by the way.
No.
I don't think I've got a backswing anymore.
Well, I never did, so that's another story. I'm going to drag you back to the Ryder Cup. Surprise.
No need to drag me. I'm bound in.
I know, The captaincy, what was your philosophy coming into that? Was it a bit of pieces of the guys that you'd worked under before?
You learn everything about captaincy and by the captains you played under. I mean, John Jacobs was a sweetheart, a darling. Tony was magnificent, transformed everything. And Bernard was a great captain. You do your own thing in the end. It's your decisions. I had wonderful help. I was at the centenary dinner for Sunningdale. And the guest speaker was a chap called David Purdy.
I know him, yeah.
A gynecologist, funnily enough.
Yes.
And he was such a great orator. I couldn't believe I was here. He was just magnificent. So I went up to him After he'd finished, I said, excuse me, Sam Turnstall. He looked at me and said, oh, I know exactly who you are. Yeah. I said, well, you know, I'm captain of the Ryder Cup. I know, he says. I said, well, I'd love you to help me. And he looked at me and he says, but Sam, I'm an amateur. Yeah. I said, I don't want you to play, David. But he was magnificent. I went up to his house a few times. He came to my house, spent a lot of time with him. And he didn't write my speeches. He just helped me timing into it and patience. He said to me, just before you go to the opening ceremony, have a large one of whatever your wish is. So in the team room at the Belfry, up the stairs, I've gone over to the Bamas. I'd like a large whiskey, please. Nothing in it. And I think he gave me a treble whiskey. And I just downed it.
Yeah.
And I was magnificent. Not saying I did a magnificent job.
No, I remember you were
but good. I was so calm.
Yeah.
I was so calm.
It was noticeable. You really took your time with it. And
yeah, well, that's what he taught me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what he taught me.
Yeah.
So then, of course, we've won. We did two speeches. We had an opening speech, a winning speech, and a losing speech.
Right.
And the winning speech, the week before the Ryder Cup, I had the podium delivered to my house that I was going to be standing at, the actual podium. And I went out into my garage every day and maybe for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, I had a recorder and I just kept doing my speech, just saying my speech. I could have done it backwards. And the losing speech, I never looked at. I never opened it once.
Really?
I've still got it.
Right.
It's still unlooked at.
That's interesting.
And so it's Sunday night and we've won. So I've gone up to the barman and he's given the same again, the large whiskey. I've downed it. No, it's not enough. I need another one, please.
Really?
Give me another one. Nope, I had three.
Wow.
Three, because the closing ceremony was probably more important than the opening ceremony because we'd won and you don't want to be up there gloating or whatever. It's got to be absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And Curtis was a great friend, always has been, and he was magnificent. He said something very nice about, well, he brought up my mum and dad. In his speech, and then he said, "We came here, and we wanted to do the right thing and be able to stand together and have a drink on Sunday night. I think we achieved that. That was brilliant. Yeah. I really liked that."
Mm-hmm.
But the three doubles or trebles, whatever it was, I was fine. I drank all night. Uh-huh. I was sober as a judge.
Yeah, yeah.
So weird.
It's adrenaline. Probably.
So weird.
Yeah.
And I was honestly sober.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I really was.
Yeah, I believe you.
Tried it again.
Yeah,
I just go to sleep now.
Especially in match play, I always think that respect for the opponent is so important. And the first thing, I hate it when people, at the end of, even at stroke play tournaments, or, and certainly in match play, when they, isn't the first thing they do is shake hands with the opponent. They're off doing something else and they're jumping
first
around.
Thing I did.
Shake hands first.
Straight up, look him in the eye, shake his hands.
Absolutely.
No fear whatsoever.
Make me sound old-fashioned.
I didn't have respect for him either.
No.
I was aware of him, but I didn't want to respect him.
Yeah.
Not in the least.
No.
Not in the least. I wanted to kick his ass.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I wanted to do. And look him in the eye. And, it's all bullshit because you're shaking a bloody leaf, really. Yeah. But you never showed it. You tried not to show that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun.
Yeah, I always thought Andy North, your famous putt, he did you a favour that day because he could have walked over and shaken.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Unless he thought I was going to four putt.
Well, yeah.
Which could have happened. It's funny with his tee shot. I've hit mine and I'm not sure it's carried. I've nailed it, but it's a wee bit low and it's drawing.
Yeah.
And the last hole of the Belfry, the further left you go, the longer the carry is. But the roar when it landed, I knew it was perfect.
Yeah.
And now I'm standing next and I'm watching him hit his drive and he skied it.
Yeah.
And all I'm doing is shouting, go, go. Because I thought it might not reach the water.
Is that right?
It was that mad a sky.
Right.
And it plumped right into the middle of the water. So I'm immediately thinking, well, he's in there, one out and two. Three up beside me, he's giving me two shots from a 9 iron in.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. Well, but I still had to really... I was crying my eyes out going down the fairway, but I had to held myself together.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you're right. He gave me my moment. I had three putts to win from 25 feet, probably.
How much did that do for your kind of public profile, if you like?
Well, I haven't brought a drink since.
Right, yeah.
No, it was magnificent. People still come up to me. So I'll never forget it. You know, if I wasn't captain, that would have been the greatest moment of my career. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing that it's not the greatest thing in my career was because you're part of a team. Aye. That's the important
you're
thing.
You're just in the right place at the right time.
Just in the right place at the right time. Aye. Howard Clark had a four-footer on 17. Mm-hmm. And he missed it, mm-hmm. and the directors told me if he'd hold it, they weren't going to show it until after because of the scenario around the 18th.
Right,
you know the final green victory,
yeah.
which Howard would probably be well pissed off about. But unfortunately for him, he missed it. But no, it's very incredibly special. But this is part of a team.
Yeah, what was your thinking on when you came to be captain on pairings, order of play, who plays with who, reinforcements?
I had it done. Mm-hmm. I had it done before I went there. I had Friday mornings foursomes, Friday afternoon. I think, no, Friday morning's my choice, and I put four balls out first because I wanted them to be a bit more relaxed opening morning.
Yeah.
Foursomes is a much harder game to play, so it was four ball foursomes. I had everything there out, mm-hmm. everyone that was playing, and I had my singles order done. And I was happy as Larry.
Yeah.
One day I just ripped it up.
Aye, yeah.
I didn't actually rip it up because I found it.
Right.
I found it years later in cleaning out my desk, and there it was. And my singles order was exactly the same as what I did a year later. Because
right.
as you mentioned, because of 9/11, it was cancelled the year. So I'm talking about I had it done in a year later, it was still the same order. And basically, the other thing that happened at that centenary dinner for Sunningdale, Bugsy Hall and the members of Sunningdale, said to me, you know, in your singles, you could do a lot worse than putting your best player out first and your worst player out last, which is exactly what I did. Mm-hmm. And it was always in my head because I thought of every scenario. If you're level, you want to go ahead. If you're behind, you want to catch up. If you're ahead, I want to go further ahead, stamp on them, get them beaten. And the morning of the singles, it was just extraordinary. Well, when the draw came out the Saturday night, it was just extraordinary.
I said to somebody, I think Sam did both of these. I actually said that.
Well, when there was a huge roar in our team room, and that's very unusual.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, to look at the draw and think, Jesus.
Yeah.
Because every match looked like we could win every match. And then, you know, he had Tiger and Mickelson last two matches, which bless him, I think was a mistake. You got to have your number one and two in the world out there.
Yeah.
You know, leading your team, put them out 3 and 4 or 3 and 5 or somewhere like that. You don't need to put them out first.
Yeah.
But getting them on the course. When 8 matches were on the course, we were up in 7. Mm-hmm. You know, and we started level. So it was just a race for the line. Mm-hmm. And we got there. I mean, Paul made a magnificent up and down at 18 to win it for us. But if he'd missed that putt, we still had... I think Pierre Foulke was in the bunker on 18, all square with love.
Yeah.
There was a... Parnovic was Parnovic finished all square with Woods.
Mm-hmm.
So no, it was brilliant.
Did you get anything wrong?
Yes. There was one instance. It was Pierre Foulke and Philip Price. I thought were fabulous foursomes team. Both had similar games, mm-hmm. and I told them when they're playing Saturday afternoon. I'm not putting you out first 2 days, but you're definitely playing. First match out Saturday afternoon. And on 17, Pierre just hit his drive into the bunker. And it was 190, 200 yards to carry the burn.
Mm-hmm.
And just a wedge in from over the burn. Or you lay up and it's a 7-iron maybe. Yeah. And he's got the wood in his hand. And I should have gone in and stopped him and said, because there were one down.
Yeah.
If you hit a bad shot here, you're just giving them the match.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in play.
Yeah.
I didn't, and I should have done. Then the next day we're on 18, and it was, I think it was Darren and was it Darren and Westwood maybe? Or anyway, Darren was in the bunker on the right of 18, and I think it might have been McGinley. Was in the middle of the fairway, and Bernard Langer came up to me, Sam, I think that maybe Paul should hit first, take the pressure off Darren Sean. I said, you're dead right.
Yeah.
And I went straight in, and I wasn't going to make the same mistake twice, although I should have thought about it before Mr. Langer. I was thinking about it, but I went in and told him, and it worked. He hit a great shot in, and they won the hole.
You get emotional talking about this stuff.
Of course I do, yeah. Yeah. I'm holding myself together well. Yeah. I haven't had a drink, that's probably why.
Anyway, there are a couple of other things I wanted to mention before we're done here. The broom handle putter, you were one of the first exponents of that.
I wasn't one of the first.
Dark art.
The first.
Yeah.
Wasn't a dark art.
Why did you feel the need for that?
Well, I hit a putt. I remember where it was on a green in, I think it was Sweden. And what the hell was that? It just went off my hands. I had no idea what it was. Mm-hmm. And it was a twitch. And this plagued me. And I ended up in France in 86, maybe. Mm-hmm. And the best golf I played of my life. I could have won the tournament by 10 shots comfortably. And I had a 15-footer in the last green to finish second. I should have been 10 clear, but I had this twitch. And I putted it up to a foot, and I knew I wasn't going to hold it. I just knew I couldn't get it in the hole from a foot. And it was just the right hand just takes over, and there's nothing you could do, nothing I could do. I went to see a hypnotist.
Really?
I tried everything to get rid of it. And then a few years earlier, I'd been in America, and I saw this big thing in the putting rack, and it was a huge thing. I said, what is that? And it was the sergeant.
Orville Moody.
He had a long putter. I don't think he ever used it, but it was there.
Yeah.
And I picked it up and I said, Christ, that's not bad. Mm-hmm. And what it did was, it was one-handed putting. Mm-hmm. I just putted with my right hand, and it became so simple. Mm-hmm. The twitch was gone in seconds.
Yeah.
And I know the story's been out there, and I really did get on the snooker table. And I used to put it on the blue spot, and I could hit it as hard as I wanted into the corner pockets.
Right.
Just slam bang right in the middle every single time. And
that would be quite a relief because, I mean, that would have finished you.
Yeah,
if you hadn't been...
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I think I found a way. I'd have found a way. Right. I would definitely have found a way.
Right.
You know, there are many different grips out there now. You know, I might have found one of them.
That's true.
Pencil, pistol, grip, whatever.
Claw,
yeah. But it was beautiful. Yeah. It was a thing of beauty. It was a lovely way to putt. I was sad when they banned it, but... anchoring. I can still use it. I still use it now, but I don't anchor.
Mm-hmm.
I just hold it beside my left cheek, you know, like they hold it out here now.
Yeah.
And it was nice for me, you know. And I felt sorry for a lot of amateur golfers and that in their 50s had found this, gone along with me and found this way of putting. And when they banned it, they couldn't do it. And it just didn't seem right to me.
Mm. I want to take you back to the 1983 Southern Open.
Yes, Ronnie Black.
How much could that have changed your life, or would it have changed your life?
Oh, 100%.
If you won the playoff to win.
100%. I mean, I had a 10-footer on the last green to win, and everything was shaking. It was funny, I'd not really been that nervous, and I missed it. So we were down the playoff, and I said to him, stupidly, I said, geez, I could barely get the putter back there. But it was the three woods.
That would have helped him a lot, I'm sure.
And well, we were both hit three woods down. It's just a wedge in. And he caught his a wee bit fat and plugged it in the front bunker. And the pin's only on to 6-7 yards. So I've hit it 35 feet past the hole because he's got no shot, really. And he came out the bunker to 34 feet, a foot in front of my ball. And it's my putt. And I put it, and I've stopped like an inch short of going in. I didn't care. I didn't care. I went up and tapped it in. I'm standing the side of the green.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, I'm going to win in America.
Yeah.
I'm going to win in America.
Yeah.
I'm going to win in America. And he hold it. Dirty Torag, hold it. And he beat me on, the fifth extra hole, which was sad. I would have gone to America, no question. I mean, we couldn't, as we talked about earlier, we couldn't get into America. The tour school was too difficult because you had to miss the last three or four events in Europe, which would screw up your chances of doing really well in that order of merit, to go over there and maybe get your card. You would have to go at regional qualifying, then final qualifying. So I never gave it. I never even tried. So if I'd won, if that hadn't been that way, I would have had 3 years exemption in America. But then I come back to Europe and won three times the next year in Europe in 84,
mm-hmm.
finished second in the money list and never looked back. And was never happier because I'm a very much a home bird.
Yeah, yeah.
When I got my card for the Champions Tour, even then, I still had to go through regional qualifying and final qualifying for seven cards over 1,000 entrants, and I got my card. And when I got my card, I went round the back of the clubhouse and I just sat and cried.
Really?
Oh, it meant so much to me. Well, this was my future.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, this is Nirvana. This is America where, you know, it all happens.
Yeah, you have been known to cry on occasion.
Yeah, that's all right. Don't make me a bad person. But I hated it. I never played one round even remotely close to how well I could play, even at that time. Just couldn't stand being away from home. I mean, you finish on a Sunday night and you're not starting to the next Friday. What are you going to do? I ended up getting into Barnes & Noble, the big bookshop. I'd been there every day having coffees and that, because you couldn't go on the toot, you know, and just couldn't, not at that age. And never lasted 6 months, and then come back and won the money list 3 times on the seniors tour in Europe, and had a great time getting home every weekend.
Mm-hmm. I know you don't play competitively now. What do you miss about it?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing at all.
I thought you'd say everything.
No, God, no. I've had my day. I had a wonderful time.
Right.
You know, no.
You don't miss the camaraderie part of it?
No, not at all. Not at all. I've got plenty of friends, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've got... yeah, Scotsman, the guy. No, but I was Sunningdale.
Yeah.
I love Sunningdale. I was assistant there in 71. And I've got some great friends up there. We play golf 3 times a week. Very comfortable being at home. I've got 3 beautiful kids, 4 dogs, now 3. One passed away, sadly. Yeah. But I just love my home life. So don't miss a thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all said, certainly not my line, but it was me that I thought it up for me anyway, that in the end, all we will have is memories.
Mm-hmm.
And just for God's sake, don't get dementia.
Aye, that's right.
Because I've got some great memories, you know, great stuff to, you know, sit back and just think about. And
yeah. You enjoy the commentary as well. I mean, yeah.
I love the commentary, yeah. Yeah, I love it, yeah. It's good fun.
Yeah.
Kind of know what I'm doing, so it's not...
What's your philosophy on that? What's your role, do you think?
Like, well, David Mould, who's our director, producer, I never know what's the right word, which it is director, I think, but anyway... He told me a few years ago, because I'm always writing these notes and doing all this homework. He said, Sam, stop. You don't need all that stuff. We have a lead commentator who does all that, does all the stats and everything like that. Your job is to be the colour.
Right.
Oh, just lit up with that. It's just magnificent. Yeah, yeah. So basically, it's always been, I'm at home watching the golf and just don't swear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's exactly what it is. Mm. The BBC were great. I worked with Peter for a number of years. He was just magnificent to work. I mean, what a man to learn off.
Well, I used to go to his house and interview him and just sit there and listen.
Yeah.
You know, it was one
for hours. He was a great companion and a great teacher. Remember him giving me a bollocking when they got up the last at the Open, not even the last group, just maybe the second last group in the crowd or roar, and I'd start to say something. He'd go, psh.
Yeah, just let it happen.
Just listen.
Yeah.
Listen to what they're getting. He was so right. Mm-hmm. So right.
Yeah.
And what was his great mate? Used to be the... Anyway, if you can't improve the picture, shut up.
Right. Yeah.
And it was so right. You know, silence is sometimes loud enough.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the camaraderie more there. I remember the first day I was going to commentate. And I'm heading back to my room about 10:30, 10:45. And I stopped at the lift. I've only got to talk tomorrow. So I went back to the bar, had a few more.
Yeah.
It's a very relaxed form of golf.
Well, it's not an easy thing to do, but it's easy in the sense that head.
You just have
to say what you know.
When you have the knowledge that I've got, or have the experience that I've had 43 years, 44 years out there.
Exactly.
It's very easy. Yeah. You know, you know what they're going through. You know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You can see them about to make a mistake.
There's not much happening that you haven't seen before.
No, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So, anyway, I'm going to finish up with, I should have introduced you as this, Sam. You're now Dr. Torrance, of course, since your honorary degree from the University of St.
Doctor
Andrews.
Doctor of Law.
Doctor of Law,
Doctor
yes.
of Law. Yeah. It was magnificent, a wonderful honor.
Mm-hmm.
Some wonderful people. I met some wonderful people that day. Dame Mary, she's just an amazing lady, the main lady there at St. Andrews University, the history. The wee cap that they doff on the head, It's been like 300 years old,
yeah.
and they've been using it for 300 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Quite extraordinary. I've always loved St Andrews, my favourite town, one of my favourite towns in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd never been there apart from an Open or a Dunhill Cup or a Scottish Open where it's busy.
Mm-hmm.
But I built a course there up at the Fairmont.
Yeah.
And I spent 3 months there in the winter, and the town is just magnificent. Yeah. All the wee nooks and crannies,
mm-hmm.
little restaurants and coffee shops, and just such a lovely place.
Yeah. Did you look good in the gown? I've only seen pictures, but did the gown fit? I mean, I felt
very good. Yes. It was certainly above my station.
Yes.
Well, I mean, left school at 13. I wasn't going to get a doctor or law, but I understood what they were doing. It was nothing to do with being a professor or law or anything. It was just a recognition of what I'd done in golf, and it was lovely.
Yeah. Good.
It was a great day.
Well, that is the perfect way to finish. Sam, thank you for your time. It's been enjoyable as ever.
Pleasure, Johnny. Pleasure.
Well, hopefully we'll do it again sometime.
Yes, well, if I'm still kicking.
Yeah, thanks again. Cheers.
All right, Johnny.
Yeah, Sam Torrance there, certainly one of the stalwarts of a pivotal period in the Ryder Cup and indeed in the development of the European Tour itself. As always, big thanks to Sam and Huggy for taking the time to sit down and have that chat. Well, that's our last interview before the Cup gets underway, but make sure to come back next time when Huggy catches up with another former team member, England's Oliver Wilson.
I think Nick tried to do his best. I actually genuinely do. I just don't think he was suited for the job, personally.
Yeah.
He's not really much of a man manager, and you've got different personalities on the team all kind of needing a little bit of something different. And I don't think he was able to give everyone that.
That's next time on The Thing About Golf.